principle taken from there. But anyway, I wonder if you've ever paid attention to the phrase, or used it, probably have, talking about the last straw. That's the last straw, the final straw, or maybe even the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. That's what I want to talk about. And the lesson grows out of a story that I ran across from a number of years ago, a lot of years ago, back in the horse and wagon days. But it's a good illustration. And it goes like this. It was a rickety wagon that the man was using. He had been moving goods for many years, and he was quite good at it. The family needed to be moved across town, so he piled their worldly possessions onto his wagon. The last load made quite a pile on the wagon, but it appeared the wagon was holding up. And all that was left of that last load was an empty hat box. He casually tossed it on the wagon, pleased that he would not have to make another trip in the thing. And all of a sudden, a loud snap followed, and with a shudder, the wagon collapsed. And, of course, everything came tumbling down. It took the man 3 days to repair the wagon and carry the furniture across in 2 sensible-sized loads. But, you know, the story said he left the hat box behind because, after all, it was the hat box that broke his wagon. Now, when I listened to that story, I laughed, and then I thought, you know, that's a great illustration. I got to thinking about a more modern one. You Steve Urkel fans, if you remember, there was an episode where Carl and Urkel got into an argument about a shelf that covered about half the garage. Carl had it packed to the ceiling, and it was down to a little beach ball, you know, the blow-up kind. And Carl said, no, maximum weight is on that shelf. I know how much it'll hold. And Urkel is like, Carl, this can't weigh but a fraction of an ounce. That's ridiculous. They get into a heated argument, and finally Carl screams, well, just throw it up there. And you can imagine he throws it up there, and everything comes crashing down. It's the last straw. It's the final piece. It is, there is a beach ball's worth of weight that can bring everything down. There is a hat box that can cause a wagon to just give way. There is a limit. And when you talk about a limit, you can also talk about limits that human beings reach. And that's why we use such a phrase as, it's the straw that broke the camel's back, or it's the last straw or the final straw or whatever. Because people have a tendency to focus on the final straw, or the hat box, or the beach ball. It's the final matter that precedes some great problem, and they focus on that. And you know, there may be a lot of, and usually are, a lot of other factors that go in that have made a greater contribution. You can look at the wagon. There are plenty of things that were a lot heavier than the hat box that contributed to that crash. And like, you know, Urkel's beach ball, there were plenty of very heavy things on that shelf. But it's the last straw, and even though it's very minor, it's the last straw when everything comes crashing down that gets all the attention. So I want to talk a little bit about that in several different situations that I think are fairly common to us all. Turn with me, if you will, to Luke 12. I remember years ago, there was a family that I knew, and I was still a kid, but there was a family that I knew, and they seemed to get along a lot better than, you know, maybe my own did. And there's a lot of love in that family, and that's the way it looked. And anybody looking from the outside would remark, you know, how close they were and so forth. Long story short, there were, I don't know, several siblings, and a parent died. And when the parent died, and I think this was the last of 2 living parents, but when that last parent died, they got into one of the most bitter wars over dividing up what the parent had. And, you know, the parent wasn't a millionaire or anything, but had some property and so forth. And they got into one of the most bitter wars I'd ever seen. And I remember as a kid, you know, just being shocked by all of that and people remarking how that was very common. That folks, even though they may be very close or they look to be very close, they'll fight over, you know, the will and the property and all of that kind of thing, and sometimes very bitterly. And people tend to look at that, you know, everything's going great, everything's just fine, it's just wonderful, And if the parent hadn't died, or the will hadn't been just so, or whatever it might be, then there never would have been any trouble. And yet, if you start looking a little deeper, you realize, no, there are a lot of other problems that go into it. I want to look at a biblical illustration of that. If you'll go with me to Luke chapter 12, and you notice Jesus is in the midst of a very serious conversation. I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but it is a very serious teaching that he's doing. And some guy runs up to him in verse 13 out of the group in the audience and just interrupts him because he's got something else on his mind and he wants Jesus to deal with his situation. So, Master, our teacher, verse 13, speak to my brother that he may divide the inheritance with me. Some people say Jesus is very annoyed, and you can see it in what he says. I don't know, but what he did say to the man is this: man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? I've read, you know, from the ancient times and so forth, and the language that's used here, there was an appointed magistrate, just like we have them. You need to fight something, you go to court, and you fight it. But here, it's like running up to the preacher or whatever and saying, settle this family dispute. And it's like, no, not my business. I don't want to get involved in that. And so, then Jesus, though, turns, and if you'll notice, the man is focusing on his inheritance and what his brother perhaps won't give him. But Jesus digs deeper into what's going on. I want you to listen carefully to what follows here. He said unto them, in other words, turning back to the crowd that he's teaching, and he's going to teach from this, and now it's an illustration, take heed and beware of covetousness. Now, covetousness is a particular term, but it means you want something. You want something that belongs rightfully to someone else, and you want it bad enough that you're willing to do something, to go to some lengths, sometimes illegally so, to get it. It's like coveting your neighbor's wife and taking her into an adulterous relationship. So he said, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things which he has or possesses. And then he tells a parable. And you know this parable. It's the parable of the rich man that was very rich and he's gaining, you know, all the time. And so he thought to himself, what do I do? Because I don't even have room to store my wealth, is the idea, and my increased wealth. And he said, hey, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to tear down the barns that I've got or the storage buildings I've got, and I'm going to build bigger ones, greater ones, so I can house all my wealth. And I'm going to say to my soul in verse 19, soul, you have much goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And this is where God says to him in verse 20, you fool, tonight your soul is required of you. And Jesus goes on to make the point there. And notice in verse 21, so is he that lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Many years ago, someone asked me to preach a lesson, and I think they wanted me to preach against being rich. I said very clearly, the Bible never teaches against being rich. I think there's anything wrong with being rich. There's nothing wrong with being ambitious, gaining wealth. In fact, if you've got the means to do that, but with it goes a lot of responsibility. But one of the things that is certainly true, no matter if you're poor or you're rich or anywhere in between, regardless of your pursuit of wealth, be rich toward God. Now, when you dig down in this, what's the last straw? To the brother, maybe, the last straw was, he's got the inheritance, and I want part of it. And some have speculated he had the double portion in keeping with the law or whatever. It doesn't even matter. He had something, his brother had something that he wanted. And the final straw was, he wasn't getting it, and so now this is blowing up into such a mess that he's going public with it. And he's running up to Jesus and he's saying, Jesus, make him give me my part of the inheritance. And Jesus looks at him and then turns to the crowd, and Jesus said, you've got a lot of other problems going on here, much deeper than the last straw. And you need to deal with the problems you've got. You've got a problem of covetousness. You've got a problem of, you know, having the wrong perspective or priorities. You're looking at the earthly wealth and it's the most important thing. I'm trying to teach you the gospel. I'm the Son of God on earth trying to teach you the gospel. And all you can be concerned with is how much money you're going to get. You're like the fool who built bigger and bigger barns to the day that God required his soul. And that's everyone, verse 21, who doesn't put God first and is first rich toward God. If you're rich toward God, it doesn't matter if you have the wealth of David or Abraham or whomever. If you're rich toward God, everything's fine and it has the correct priority. If you're not, it'll never matter how much you have. You're not getting anything in the end. You're not getting what you will ultimately want. The final straw doesn't always tell the story. And I think you can see this in this story. But let me turn to something else. If you'll go over with me to Matthew chapter 14. And I'm not going to look a long time at this story. But you can see in context, Jesus has fed the 5,000. And this is where Jesus very famously in Matthew 14 walks on the water. And of course, all kinds of jokes and everything else that are made about that. But we know that miraculously or divinely, however you want to put that, the Son of God walked on the water. Sometimes people, as Peter will in this story, they lose their faith or they lack faith to accomplish whatever they need to accomplish the task at hand. Now, if you know the story here, here's what happened. The disciples are on a boat and Jesus comes walking on the water. They're afraid. And finally, Peter calls out to him, if you remember this story, he said, well, if you're, you know, you're who you say you are, then call to me and let me come to you. Which meant he'd have to get out of the boat and walk on the water himself. Now, that takes great faith. And I believe that that's very much like we are a lot of times when we've got faith in Jesus. We know we do. And we do. And we've got enough faith that would bring us to the point of saying something like Peter said. If you're Jesus, if you're God, if you're who you say you are, you call to me and I know you can walk on water and I know you're the Son of God, so I know if you tell me to come to you, I can get out of this boat and walk on water myself. And we believe that right up to the point that we reach the final straw. And it can be anything. It can be a set of circumstances that piles in on you. You've got faith, you're exercising your faith, you believe in God, and then you have to deal with this, and you have to deal with that, and you have to deal with the other thing. And sometimes something that in other circumstances would not even begin to affect you blows you, if you'll pardon the pun, out of the water. Now think about it for a moment. We've had storms. You've been in storms. Maybe even the news tells you this is going to be a bad storm. The wind kicks up, the lightning starts crashing, and all of that kind of thing. And most of us, we don't have any phobia about storms, and it's nothing. We don't worry about a storm. I mean, a storm hits, it comes, it goes. Maybe it blows some limbs off, perhaps it even knocks a tree or two down. Maybe Edward has to miss a couple of weeks of work, or a couple of weeks because he's at work. But the point is, it doesn't knock us out. It doesn't take away our faith. When you look at Peter here, I want you to notice exactly what this text says. He walked on the water. He got out. He stepped on the water. And the Bible says, when he saw the wind boisterous. Notice that. What does that mean? It means it's a big wind, a heavy wind. It doesn't mean it's a cyclone or a hurricane or anything like that, but it means it's a big wind. And when you stop to think about it, it's like, big deal. I mean, really. You are walking to the Son of God on water. And all it is some wind. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he began to sink. You know, things that wouldn't even cause you to flinch are things that will blow you out of the water. It's like you've had a day where everything went wrong. And you handled it, and you prayed, and you handled the next thing, and you prayed, and you handled the next thing, and you prayed, and you got in your car, and you drove down the street, and somebody ran a stop sign, and you lose it. I mean, you just lose it. How dare you? Maybe you curse and swear and do all those things because somebody ran a stop sign and ran out in front of you. Now, I get it. It's annoying. But something that if the day was going great, it's Father's Day, and everybody's doing everything for me. I feel great, man. And nothing is going to ruin my day. and somebody runs a stop sign, the most you might do is go, man, that's dangerous. You ought not be doing that. You're going to get yourself killed one day. That might be the worst you do, but it doesn't affect you in the least. It's like the wind on a normal day. But if it comes at the wrong time, it's the final straw. Now, what's really going on? Especially when a person starts losing their faith. God doesn't love me. God is not going to help me. God will not help me in this situation. I'm just cursed. I'm not like other people. I'm not the person that God cares about. I'm not the one God is going to take care of. He takes care of other people, but He won't take care of me. This is happening, that's happening, that's happening, that's happening. You start adding it up like a, you know, an adding machine or whatever, totaling in your mind. And you lose your faith. It's the last straw. Whatever probably minor in reality incident it is, whatever wind comes along, it just blows you right out. What really happened there? What happened is you didn't stop to remind yourself all the way in every single situation of what God actually says. It does us well to, and I'm going to say it like this, habitually repeat to ourselves things like this. All things work together for good. How many of us in here cannot finish that verse? Do you love the Lord? Is the problem, the deeper problem, your lack of love for the Lord? Your lack of trust in the Lord? See, Peter was doing fine walking on the water. We forget that. The world knows Jesus walked on the water, makes all kinds of jokes. But what the world doesn't realize is there were two people who walked on the water that day. Jesus walked on the water, and the one Jesus that trusted in Jesus walked on the water. You can walk on the water every day if you trust in the Lord. You can accomplish everything you need to accomplish if you trust in the Lord. But if some minor wind comes along and blows you out, the problem is not the wind. It wasn't with Peter. It was the lack of trust. All things work together for those who love the Lord. I wonder if you ever stop to think that Genesis is one of the longest books in the Bible. It's very long. 50 chapters worth. And that a full 25% of Genesis is devoted to one man. One character. That's the man Joseph. And that the story that it's devoted to, if you pick up reading about chapter 37, even though he's mentioned before that, but his story as a teenager who's, you know, attacked by his brother, sold into slavery, you know the story. Rises to be second in, you know, in the line to Pharaoh, oversees all of the, you know, the food and stores during the famine. I wonder if you ever stopped to think that 25% of the book of Genesis is devoted to telling a story of a person that had everything go wrong that could go wrong. I mean, his father loves him, and you would think that would be great, but no, his father loves him, and unfortunately there's favoritism, so it goes wrong. He's got a big family, and you'd think that'd be great, because, you know, we talk about strength and numbers and all of that, but no, not for Joseph, because they're jealous. He gets sold into slavery, but he ends up in a good situation. A favorable man takes him in, named Potiphar, puts him in charge of everything, because he trusts him so much. You'd think that'd be great, but he's got a sorry wife who wants Joseph to commit fornication. And so everything blows up. He goes into the prison. And then he's in prison wrongfully, and you'd think that would be okay when those two officials come along from Pharaoh, and he helps straighten that out, and now somebody right next to a man who can grant a pardon at any moment, he's got the ear of that Pharaoh, and the dude forgets him. You're talking about a person who for about 13 years, how do I know that? He was about 17 when his brother sold him into slavery, and he was about 30 when he finally got out of prison. About 13 years, everything that could go wrong went wrong. And you know, the Bible is interesting because it keeps telling us in that 25% of Genesis, and the Lord was with Joseph. Now, if I were a cynic of the Bible, I'd look at that and I'd say, yeah, boy, he's really with him. Everything he touches goes bad. Every good thing that should work out for him, it goes wrong. And I wonder if you've ever known someone like that. Worse yet, have you ever been someone like that? And have you known or been someone who went through a time for years, maybe, like Joseph, where everything went wrong, and you've tried to hold on to your faith? You've tried to say to yourself over and over, the Lord is with me, the Lord's going to take care of it, and then something just comes along and blows you away. And it could have been any of many things with Joseph. But it didn't. And Joseph has the statement in Genesis chapter 50, and if you'll go down to verse 20, he finally says to his brothers at the death of their father, you don't need to worry. I mean, I'm not here for vengeance. No, you meant it to me. You meant to do evil to me, and that's true. But God meant it for good. God had my back all the way. I never had to worry, even when all those things were going wrong. You think God can't know what's going on and still bring me to a place where everything's great? Beyond my wildest imaginations, in the pit when my brothers were bargaining for my life to be sold away. Could I have ever imagined God is looking at me in that pit and saying, Joseph, you just hold on, because 13 years from now, son, you are going to be ruler, second ruler over the biggest empire in the world. How can you know that? How can you see the things God can see? You can't see them in Joseph's life, and you can't see them in your own. And when that final straw comes along, that wind that's going to blow your faith away, stop and remind yourself, God has got this. He's in control. And if I just love God, like Romans 8 says, I trust God, I keep my trust in God, like Peter had when he stepped out of the boat into a water where there was a storm going on, and walked on the water. If I just keep my trust in Jesus, forget the wind. God's got the wind. Just trust in Him. I tell you, there's another area, too, that strikes me of being the final straw. Maybe this one's a little harder to see, but I want you to turn a few pages back to Matthew 7. And this is when we get into the whole, do we judge, do we not judge? I don't judge people. You hear people say that, you know, even members of the church. I don't judge anybody. And you're thinking, is that really what Matthew 7 teaches? Now, I get it that Matthew 7 can be a complicated, you know, complex thing. When to judge, when not to judge, how much judgment, all of that kind of thing. But I think what tends to happen is that humble people, and I'm not going to deal with everybody in the world, but let's just talk about good-hearted, humble people. Good-hearted, humble people tend to focus, and rightfully so, because that's what Jesus is teaching here. They do tend to focus on the beam in their own eye. They know that they've got problems, they know they have things wrong, and they tend to look at that, and that's what you should look at. But what happens is that sometimes people are so focused on their own sins or weaknesses that they don't judge like they should. Jesus is not teaching, and you're welcome to come study this with me if you want to, but I think we understand this. Jesus is not teaching here that you never make a judgment about anything. No, Jesus is talking about the hypocrite that wants us to look at the wrongs of everybody else without seeing their own faults. But the good, honest, humble individual, that's not their worry. Their worry is, I've got sins and I've got problems, so who am I to judge somebody else? And so what they end up doing is they end up accepting, going along with, if not even approving, of things that are wrong, blatantly wrong, in other people. Now, I'm not saying in that you can be a hypocrite and run out and point a finger at everybody and that's going to get you anywhere. That's not what he's teaching either. But swine are still swine. And if you look at the passage, you notice that was the point. Cast not your pearls before swine. It doesn't matter if you've got a speck in your eye or not. If you've got problems or not, you've still got to be able to recognize who is doing wrong in this world. There's another side of that, and I won't really touch on it very much. I'll come back to the point I was just making. But you know, there's another side of it where the good, humble, honest person is really trying to help but gets things all out of kilter. And then begins to be weighted over here toward finding fault with everybody else. And I think Jesus is certainly teaching against that here. You find fault with yourself. If you're going to find fault with other people, then find fault with yourself first, is the idea. But let's go back to the original point. Go with me to Psalm 39. Because in Psalm 39, I think, and I stress I think, although I'm pretty sure, I believe that's what David is talking about in Psalm 39. What is David talking about? Well, I don't know exactly when in his life he wrote this. I don't know that anybody does. But we all know that David was a man who had some problems. And that if we were to try to fit him toward Matthew 7, we'd say, if David, if you're going to point out wrongs and faults and so forth in other people, then you need to be considering your own tendencies toward the Bathshebas and the bathtub and all of that kind of thing. And we'd be right. And yet you'll notice something that David says. And I do believe that David, with all of his faults, with all of his problems, was a humble individual. I do believe that, although there were times when he could not be. That he was an honest individual, although there were times when he could not be. And that he was a penitent individual. He really wanted to change what's wrong and do what's right and live for God. And I believe that, and I think the Bible bears that out. This is such an interesting psalm to me. And if you look at this psalm, David starts it with this. Look at verse 1. I said, it's almost like a declaration, you know, kind of like the declaration you made, I won't judge anybody, or I don't judge anybody. I said, I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle, notice, while the wicked is or are before me. I was dumb with silence. I held my peace, even from good, notice that, and my sorrow was stirred. To the point that verse 3, my heart was hot, some of your translations say angry within me. While I was musing, the fire burned, and then I spoke with my tongue. Now, I've looked at that passage, and I admit to you, I've looked at that passage and said, what? What are you talking about? It occurs to me that this may be what David is talking about. I can find a real scenario where this is the case. Let us suppose David has done something like we know he did with Bathsheba. In his life at some time. Could have even been years before. It doesn't matter. Once you've done it, you've done it. Let's suppose he's done something like that. And that his commitment to God of turning things around and being different was 100% genuine. Because I do believe that. When he repented, he really repented. That's why he's a man after God's own heart. And let's suppose that he thought to himself and said, you know, what I need to be concerned with is my own life, my own problems. Because I can sin worse than anybody around me. I mean, after all, you know, we've all done something wrong, but a lot of us would tend to say, how many of us have taken another man's wife and killed their husband? Well, you know, I don't know about you, but I haven't seen that happen too many times. So maybe David is looking at himself and he's saying, I'm the worst there is. So I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to judge anybody. Because I can be worse than everybody else. So I'm just going to refrain from that. I won't talk about people even when they're wicked. Notice verse 1 at the end of verse 1. I will check myself. We would say today, I will keep my mouth. And I won't speak against the wicked even when they're right in my face with it. I won't talk about it. I'll be quiet. And I was. And you know what's going to happen to a good person? A person who understands the truth, a person who knows wrong is wrong. You can make that. You can accept that for yourself. You can take a vow. I won't ever judge anybody else again. And then people are going to do things and you're going to know that it's wrong. And you're going to know that unlike you, they don't care. You care. And that's the difference. But they don't. And they're going to go right on being wicked, and they're going to go right on sinning, and they're going to go right on doing wrong, and you're going to hold back. And what's going to happen to any good, right-thinking person is the more you hold back, the more angry inside you're going to get. At yourself, at someone else, at the sin they're committing, at the wrong they're doing, at the people they're hurting. You're going to get mad about it. And when the final straw comes, and it will, somebody is going to do something someday, and you're going to blow. And sometimes it is going to be at a far less infraction than the many things you let go. But that's what happens to us when we do things, you might as well say, the wrong way. I'm trying to be humble. I'm trying to deal with my faults, and you should. But you know, even dealing with your own faults does not mean that you don't have a right to say wrong is wrong. You may feel like, who am I to be saying this? David goes on in the psalm. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you can read it. But I'll summarize some points here. As David goes on in verses 3 and following, he starts talking about life goes on. Here I am with this crazy intention that I have to never speak, to never say anything against anybody. And life goes on, and sin or wickedness or wrong perpetuates. And what I find myself doing is living life on the sideline, never pointing out anything that's wrong, never correcting, never helping anybody. Because I'm willing to take a stand against what is wrong. And here's the point. That's why. And I know some of you talk about this sometimes with me. Maybe you talk about it without me. No, but you certainly talk about it with me. You say, you know, Michael, you get up in the pulpit and you talk about things you've done. You talk about your faults, your failures. That's why. Because if I can't stand against the wrong I do, how in the world do I stand against the wrong that somebody else does? And I think that's what God is saying. God is not saying you go out and you straighten you up to the point that you are absolutely perfect, no flaws, no faults, no wrongs, and then you come back and you tell somebody when they're wrong. Now, do you know any place in the Bible that teaches that? I don't. I do, however, find plenty of teaching in the Bible that says, don't be a hypocrite. If you're going to point out the wrong in somebody else, then point out the wrong in yourself. See, David says, life goes on, and sin perpetuates. And the longer that I sit on the sideline, I refuse to see life in its real perspective. And the real perspective is, we are all headed to judgment by God. Me and all the rest of these people. And if I want to do what I'm supposed to do, then I'm going to point out what's wrong in my life to myself. And I'm going to be willing to say to other people, I sin too. But that doesn't change or lessen the fact that what you're doing is wrong. I used to have said to me before people realized what was going to come back. A lot of times people that I knew in my family, whatever. But, you know, you make a mistake. You call yourself a preacher. I finally started saying, you're right, I call myself a preacher. I sure do. I don't preach harder against anybody than I do myself. And I maybe would just start and tell them, you know, I do this and I've done that and I've done that and it's dead wrong. Now let's talk about what you're doing. What are you going to say to that? And that's exactly the point David is making that I think God is making through David. Yes, you've sinned grievously, you're wrong, you repent, and you help other people. That's life. And I think David realizes, verses 7 through 10 to me stand out in the psalm if you're looking at it. David realizes he is and has been a sinner. And that wrong is wrong no matter who does it. And that he points that out. He doesn't justify himself. And I want you to understand something because I think this is what's going on. I don't judge anybody. Why? Because you won't judge yourself? If you're doing wrong, judge it. If you're doing wrong, admit it. If you're doing wrong, be willing to change it. But saying, I don't judge anybody else, which somehow then says, I won't judge myself either, or it lets me off the hook, it doesn't work that way. And I believe that's what's being said in this psalm. The only appeal for justification is to God. And what David ends up saying, if you'll look at verses 12 and 13, the end of the psalm there, God is the only one who can justify. God's the only one who can make you right. And all of us have to go to God with whatever sins we have. And it doesn't matter what they are. We all have them. We all need God. We all have to go to Him. Read one final passage with me and then I'm going to close. Look at James chapter 3. And I was thinking about this. Wes taught a class at Wendy's. What was it, last week, Wes? But Wes taught on this in James chapter 3 at the end of the chapter. And I thought it was an excellent job that he did. And he was talking about the tongue and he was talking about wisdom. And I want you to notice this right at the very end of the chapter, verse 13. Who is a wise man among you? Who has knowledge, the ideas from God among you? And then he starts talking about, you know, what you do and how you speak and how you act with your brethren. But I want to drop down, if you will, with me to verse 17. Wisdom that is from above is first pure. Now notice this. Is first pure. What does that mean? I think it's honest. I think you're willing to be honest with yourself, with God, with other people. What I've done is wrong. And it's as wrong as God, you say it is wrong. There's no justification, no rationalization. You can't lessen it. You've done it. It's first pure. And then notice how he goes on here when he says, it's then peaceable. Because it's the one who's not being the hypocrite who has the right to reach out to other people and make peace. Even when there's wrong being done on the part of the other person, and there's a whole lot of that going on in the context of this book. And then it's gentle, notice. And it's easy to be entreated. In other words, it's not two people squaring off like two bulls in the pasture. Nobody's going to give an inch. Nobody's going to admit wrong. We're just going to go at it and butt heads and clash horns until one of us kills the other one. No, it's easy to be entreated. Because a person who is right with God and who is honest, if you've got something to say, and it doesn't matter who you are, old, young, child, adult, sinner, saint, if you say something that I need to hear, I need to hear it. And so it's easy to be entreated. In other words, you can say something. You can request something. You can even make a charge. Notice, it is full of mercy and good fruits. All that I'm interested here in the end is that we both be right with God. That on Judgment Day, we get to stand locked arm in arm and go to heaven together. Isn't that the only thing that's important? Without partiality. And we can talk about the obvious prejudices that exist in the world, the racial, the this, the that. What about the prejudices that go on even between brethren? Oh, I'll tell you I'm sorry and I'll work things out with you because after all, we're friends and I like you. But that brother or sister over there, forget it. No, those kind of prejudices. And without hypocrisy. The idea of trying to fake, you know, and be fake. Through all of this process. Well, verse 18, the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. So I end by saying this. If you're, you know, if you have some relationship with somebody that is less than it should be or it could be, then let me ask you something. What was the last straw? What was the final straw, the straw that broke the relationship's back, if you will? What was the thing that put the two of you over the edge so that you never have the relationship with them that you could have or you should have again? And is it that I need to look deeper into the situation and work my way back from the final straw? Whether it was something they said or an argument or whatever it was. And say, what's really going on here? What are the deeper things that are wrong? Maybe then we can start repairing that relationship. The final straw, the last straw, the straw that broke the camel's back. Anyway, I just throw that out there. I thought it was an interesting illustration. Something maybe we all can gain from. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, you do believe Jesus is the Son of God. And tonight, you want to change your life. You want to live your life for the Lord. God is that Father, and I thought about that all day long, you know, that we preached about this morning in Luke 15. That God who is standing there watching and waiting and ready to run. You know, God loves you. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?